This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte.
Today's word on the future, together. Because the future of business isn't driven by what machines or people do alone, but by all they can achieve together. See how we can help at deloitte.com/us/innovate.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
We're going to start off looking deep into the fiction and, more importantly, the reality of espionage. Now, the word spying still has this whiff of the Cold War about it, and it might still call to mind the work of Ian Fleming, his James Bond character, or the novels of John le Carré. But clearly, as evidenced from the events of this year, long after the Cold War, clandestine operations between this country and Russia have never gone away, and they've completely changed our history. At the New Yorker Festival in 2013, staff writer David Gran sat down with a group of very distinguished spies, and I'll let him make the introductions.
Now, I'm incredibly honored to moderate such an extraordinary panel. Tony Mendez is a decorated American spy who worked at the CIA for 25 years. Known as a master of disguises, he specialized in carrying out exfiltration operations, which involve getting people out of hostile countries before they would be killed. In 1979, he devised and oversaw a daring plot to liberate six American diplomats from Iran by using the cover of creating a fake movie, which, in an unusual postmodern twist, was recently made into a movie itself, Argo. Jeff Moss is a legendary computer hacker and founder of DEF CON, the largest conference and community for hackers in the world. In 2009, he was sworn in as a member of the U.S. Homeland Security Advisory Council. Stella Rimington was a trailblazing spy and the former head of MI5. After being recruited by MI5 in 1967, she quickly rose through the ranks, working in every important branch of the agency, including in counter-espionage, counter-subversion, and counter-terrorism. In 1992, Rimington was named the head of MI5, the first woman ever to run the agency. Since retiring from the service in 1996, she has proven herself to be an equally talented writer, producing a memoir as well as several popular spy thrillers. Joe Weisberg is a former officer at the CIA, where he worked undercover in the early 1990s. After leaving the agency, he went on to become a successful novelist and television writer. He has now returned to the world of espionage as the creator and producer behind the brilliant new FX series, The Americans, the show about two KGB operatives living in suburbia in the United States during the Cold War, has been hailed by critics and praised for its insights into the hidden world of espionage. So welcome you all. And Tony, we've all seen these movies, we've all read these thrillers, these images swirl in our head about what espionage is like. How much are these popular images that we have seen and that we all carry with us are real, if any?
Well, I like to think that they're all real, and we're all still doing it. Reality is a great mirror for the fantasy world. If we hadn't invented this, we couldn't possibly do it because it doesn't make sense. But let's go off and do it anyway.
Now, Stella, I read somewhere you said something about, we are not right-wing nuts going around killing people like in spy movies. Is this image, what's your reaction to the popular images that we've come to see?
I think Tony's right that behind the popular images is something, but the something behind is absolutely nothing like the thing on the top, the superficial. And there is a danger, it seems to me, that sometimes people actually believe the superficial, believe the presentation that they're given, and that can be actually damaging to the real stuff that's going on behind. We've got a series in Britain, which in Britain is called Spooks, but I think here it's called MI5, which indicates that here's MI5 and they're full of kind of elegant looking women and blokes and they're all wearing leather jackets and kind of rushing around. And they save the world every week, about five of them, from some terrible thing. You know, using gadgetry that even we have never dreamt up. And I think that kind of thing can be quite damaging, actually, when MI5 is trying to present itself, you know, as a serious organisation that's trying to protect the country against serious harm. And it's just lurking in the back of people's minds, they're those guys in the leather jackets and stuff.
Now, Joe, you take great pains in your show, The Americans, to accurately portray the spying world. But I wondered if there is a method that spies use from your own experience or knowledge that we don't see in the movies. What is the method or methods that we don't see being portrayed that are important?
Well, yeah, I have to say in general about this question that I'm one of those people who's always running around saying, look, most of what espionage is really quite dull. A lot of it is not very useful or important. That's a tough thing to say when you're sitting 10 feet from Tony Mendez. I think I have to amend it to something like, what Tony Mendez does isn't that much like most espionage.
There was a program called Mission Impossible, not the Tom Cruise version, but it was a weekly television show on Thursday night or whatever. We had to assign somebody to watch that every time. Because the next thing you know, the phone is ringing. Can you do that?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, on the show, what we try to do is, you know, the most of the work that happens at the CIA in human intelligence operations is about recruiting and running spies, right? I mean, you try to meet people, recruit them, manipulate them, and get them to give you secrets. And what we wanted to do on the show was show more of that on television, show what the human dimension of it is. But if you just do that, even that can get kind of dull. So we're trying to mix that up and at least get some of that in there.
Now, Jeff, I don't think too many of us are in this work. And I don't think our parents were encouraging us and saying, you know, I think you really should become a hacker or a covert agent. And so I was wondering, you know, how old were you when you started hacking and how did you get into this realm?
Well, I wanted to be a hacker much sooner than I became a hacker.
And how old were you? I mean, we're talking young. You look 12. Young now, but you were really young then.
I was about 12 when I wanted to, and I didn't actually meet real hackers to show me until I was probably about 14 or 15. Wow. So I was on the other side, right? I'm trying to meet the people that have the knowledge. Unfortunately, that world was full of a lot of people that didn't know what they were talking about, so they'd pass on a lot of bogus information. And it took you a long time to figure out what was true and what wasn't.
It was not. Yeah. Now, Tony, you worked as an illustrator and a graphic artist. You didn't just, you know, how did you then wind up in the CIA? It seems like a strange leap from graphic artist to covert ops in Iran.
I was an artist illustrator working in Denver, Colorado. I was 25. I had a wife and three children. I went to the office one day and saw an ad for artists to work overseas with the U.S. Navy. I went to an interview, I submitted some samples, and the fellow who was interviewing me looked at me and said, son, this is not the Navy. He put a bottle of Jim Beam up on the table. And I walked in the door as a forger counterfeiter, and 25 years later, much intrigue in between, I left for retirement, so you're supposed to know.
Yeah.
Now Stella, you went to India with your husband then, and what? You got a tap, a whisper? What happened?
I come from an era where women were not really supposed to work much after they got married. I got married, and one day my husband came home and said that he'd got a posting. He was in the diplomatic service, got a posting to India. So I thought, great, this is the point at which I give up work altogether and go off and become a wife and mother. So we went off on a three-week sail to India, which is how British diplomats went to their overseas postings in those days. And I began to get rather bored as a diplomatic wife, running jumble sales and coffee mornings and that kind of thing. And one day, somebody sidled up to me in the British High Commission compound and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Psst, do you want to be a spy?" Or...
So there was a tap.
Well, it wasn't quite like
that. I was kidding.
It wasn't quite like that. What he said was, "I've got a job as a part-time clerk typist. Would you like to take it on?" And I said, "Well, I can't type." But it didn't seem to matter, because what he was the small MI5 office that existed in the British High Commission in New Delhi in those days, and he was looking for some clerical help. So I started this job as a part-time clerk typist and ended up as Director General of MI5.
What did you type?
I was just typing his letters home, but it was a great time to be in India. It was really the height of the Cold War. India was where East met West. The place was full of spies. What MI5's office in those days was trying to do was find out who the spies were on both sides, report back, help the Indians with their security, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, this is fantastic.
Stella, your career is really interesting because it spanned so many critical kind of chapters in world history, and in terms of changes of dangers and threats, you've covered from IRA bombings to the Lockerbie bombing. And I was curious if your methods change depending on your enemy. I mean, do you approach an Al-Qaeda cell the same way you would an IRA or some other group?
Well, you have to remember I'm a counter-spy, so my job is to stop people like Tony, except they're our friends, but people like Tony from the other side of whatever it is, from being successful. So MI5's job is to try and protect the country against any threats to our national security, whatever they are. And you're right that during my career, they changed quite radically, because I joined, as I said, at the height of the Cold War, where the main threat to our security came from the Soviet Union and their allies and their efforts at espionage in our country and the countries of the West, and subversion as they tried to undermine Western democracies by spreading world communism. When, during, I suppose, the early 1970s and then on into the 80s and ever onwards, terrorism began to raise its head, as far as we were concerned, firstly from the situation in Northern Ireland, with the IRA, it's all about infiltrating these things. And we managed to infiltrate the IRA really quite effectively. We recruited a number of them, and they were prepared to tell us what was going on, etc. So the techniques were basically the same. It was about understanding your enemy, keeping your record so that you could refer back what you learned to what you already knew, and preventing, basically. Because the thing to remember about British intelligence is, differently from American intelligence, British intelligence organisations have got no executive powers. We don't have the power of arrest. We don't have a military wing. We can't kill people. We rely closely on the police service. And differently from the United States, we regard terrorism as a crime. So we aim to arrest terrorists and put them in court and try them and hopefully get them in prison.
Joe, I was curious, in the Americas, you decided to set it in the 1980s and not contemporaneously. Was that because you thought there was a clarity or a simplicity to the nature of spying then, or a kind of clear morality? Or what was the reasoning behind that?
The show was initially inspired by the events of 2010, when a group of Russian illegals were arrested in the United States. And I got a call from the presidents of DreamWorks Television who said, "Do you want to base a show on this?" And I said, "Yeah, that seems like a great idea." And then I started wandering around the streets and thinking, I don't know, the whole thing's kind of dull, really. And it took me about 2 weeks. I don't know why it didn't take 24 hours, but it took 2 weeks. And I thought, oh, you got to put it back in the Cold War. And then suddenly it's exciting. And then you have Ronald Reagan. It was really Ronald Reagan. We wanted to have Ronald Reagan screaming about the evil empire and the Soviets wanting to destroy us. So that was really the reason to put it back there.
Now, the stakes, especially when it does come to the national security, are incredibly high. Is there, I wonder, I just kind of throw this out, anyone can jump in, but is there a line you won't cross to get information, or is there one? Is there, and what's your view of whether agency, Tony or Stella, I think, or Joe, or in terms of whether intelligence agencies should be using methods like waterboarding and renditions?
Well, I'll just... Really, I'm the one who should speak on this. That, I'll just toss out one thing that I noticed when I was at the CIA, that when I was there before any of this came up, the CIA was bound by a lot of very specific rules that, in a sense, I thought everybody took on faith. Of course, you didn't torture people. That barely even needed to be said. But there were also more specific things like, you know, you didn't use journalists, for example. That was against the rules. You didn't recruit journalists as spies. And what I discovered when I was there was that every one of these things, if you really wanted to do it, you could get an exception. Right? And that came as a big discovery to me, that any one of these things might have actually been going on if there was a real need to do it. So,
or you could just change the name of it.
Change the...
My way of thinking about the assassination rule is it was sure more efficient to use a hitman than it would be to fire a cruise missile, which is what they've been thinking about doing most recently. You're going to probably have a lot of collateral damage, and you're going to kill a few kids and dogs or whatever, and it's not going to solve anything. It seems so arcane. So I have to admit to the guys in my old office that created the Predator drone kind of scenarios, they were doing us a favor. It's not very moral to do that, but it's certainly a lot more simple to do it that way. And guess what? Nobody gets killed as readily by accident.
Can I just establish a difference here between British intelligence and American? Which is that British intelligence does not kill people. If there's killing to be done, it's done by the military. And that's a clear distinction.
But I don't think we call the Predators killers. I think it's just... I don't think we call the drones, we don't refer to them as being killers. They're an instrument of war.
Yeah,
more fits more to your mold than some other mold.
I want to come back to some of the bigger questions, but just really is human intelligence still as important as it once was? Is signal intelligence more important now, given the day and age we live in and all the technology?
From my understanding, human intelligence is still just as important as it used to be. And I mean, I think that you still get the best intelligence from the human being, the agent, who is in the right place and can tell you, not only can report what's being thought, but he can tell you minute by minute what's going on. And he can also give you kind of character studies of the people he's with so that you can get a kind of rounded picture of what's going on in, be it the terrorist cell or the hostile intelligence service or wherever it is that he's reporting from. I'm quite sure that technology is an absolutely essential co-part of this, because that can fill you in on other things as well. But it can never give you, I don't think it can give you that kind of personal feel of the setup, who is most influential, who's pulling the strings, etc. So I think the two go hand in hand.
The bad guys know that your location can be tracked and your conversations listened into and your email read. So I think the technology is going to catch the really dumb ones.
I
believe that the importance of human intelligence tends to be overblown. That the idea of these human assets out there providing really important intelligence is largely mythical. There may have been a few, and there may still be a few, but there aren't many. I'm working on a theory based on no actual experience that the same may be true for electronic surveillance as well, but I haven't got there yet.
Oh. Now, in the age where we have WikiLeaks, there's been various disclosures, Snowden being the most recent. And I wondered, in this age when so much information is getting out there, how does that affect intelligence gathering, which has always relied on secrecy?
I'm just shocked this hasn't happened earlier. I mean, it's pretty amazing that they've built these systems that hold all these secrets, and they don't know who's accessed them or what's been accessed, or are there 10 Snowdens out there, and this is the only guy that's come forward? They can't answer that.
Theoretically.
Yeah. Well, that's really scary.
What struck me about both the WikiLeaks and the Snowden cases was the amount of access that these young people had to what was apparently, the crown jewels. And I couldn't quite understand what had happened to American security.
This may get, again, back to the difference between your smaller and possibly more likely to be overseen intelligence service and our larger and impossible to oversee intelligence service, that while ours is also doing exactly what you said, which is very noble, vital, and important work protecting us from a lot of threats, it's also doing a lot of stuff that really can't be explained. And that when the world is now looking, a lot of the Snowden revelations are infuriating people all over the world, and there's no explaining it. There's no going to the people around the world that are being spied on and saying, hey, I have great explanations for all of this that once you understand it, you won't be upset anymore. What the intelligence services are doing is damaging our national security in very real ways, and in ways that maybe, there's just no other way to look at it. It's doing actual damage. And it may be that there's no way to deal with that except to stop doing a lot of those things and to ask yourself, are the things we're doing, are we getting any benefit from it? So if we're spying on country X, Y, and Z, and those countries might have been neutral or might have had a positive attitude towards the United States government, and now that we're spying on them, they're really turning more against us, and you look at the damage to our national security, and you say, if on the other side, if we were spying on them, could we possibly be getting anything from spying on those countries that would enhance our national security? And the answer is, I don't know. I can't think of anything we could get from spying on that country that would actually help us. It may be that we actually might need to think of some more of a sea change in how we approach espionage.
I want to thank you all so much for coming, and I really want to thank our incredibly distinguished panelists.
The New Yorker's David Graham. He's the author of Killers of the Flower Moon, about a real case of conspiracy and murder on an Indian reservation and how the FBI dealt with it. On our panel were Tony Mendez and Joe Weisberg, formerly of the CIA, Stella Rimington, the retired chief of Britain's MI5, and Jeff Moss, founder of the Black Hat and DEFCON conferences.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of Poetry Unbound by Padre Gotuma, a poetry anthology that offers immersive reflections, keen insights, and personal anecdotes on 50 powerful poems. Focusing on poets mainly writing today, Poetry Unbound engages with a diverse array of voices that includes Ada Limon, Ilya Kaminsky, Margaret Atwood, Ocean Vuong, Layli Long Soldier, and Reginald Dwayne Betts. Poetry Unbound is now in paperback.